Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says a verification of sanctions, removal, and reliable guarantees will form the basis of any agreement reached in the Vienna talks. A new video released by U.S.-based organization documents Israel's crimes in Palestine, noting Israeli forces killed 78 Palestinian children in 2021. And Russian soldiers are in Belarus for joint military drills, as the Belarusian president has warned that his country will go to war if Russia is attacked. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's president says his country has proven its will and seriousness in talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said the verifiable removal of anti-Iran sanctions will provide the basis for an agreement. He said other negotiating parties must provide guarantees that they will not withdraw from the pact in the future. Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart. Emmanuel Macron, for his part, said Iran has a right to distrust the United States, as it was Washington that threw the JCPOA into disarray. He was referring to the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal back in May of 2018. Iran and the remaining parties have been trying to revive the agreement. Britain, France, and Germany say talks are in their final stages and that political decisions need to be made now. Joining us now from Irvine, California, is Alexander Azadgan, academic and geopolitical policy advisor. Hello, Professor Azadgan. Always a pleasure to check in with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. So we're at this point now, Alexander, where there's a one-week hiatus. Everybody comes back next week to Vienna, and after consultations with the respective capitals, your thoughts on if Tehran is going to get the guarantees that it needs for this thing to happen?
It's good to be with you, Danny, as always. The quick answer to that question is no, because several days ago we had Anthony Blinken making what we thought from a diplomatic perspective is the threatening statement that there would be no guarantee if another administration comes to power. It was more or less verbatim. This is ridiculous. If you're going to go into a multilateral agreement and make such a statement, I think it was being threatening, because what if Trump comes back is what he was suggesting or threatening or putting the idea out there. Tightening the belt around the Iranians with the timeline, because the time is on the Iran side, and that's why they're extremely nervous. Also, I'd like to know what exactly is being negotiated at this point. Obviously, this is top confidential material. All we can go by is what the mood that's being displayed in the statements that come out of the diplomats, whether it's Dr. Amir Abdullahian or the French Prime Minister, the President, or signals from Anthony Blinken, the fact that President Raisi was in Russia, and we knew this before his visit, is that Russia was really not pro-JCPOA to begin with. Russia was concerned that if JCPOA would be signed and the promise of liberalization of the Iranian economy and the GDP would have gone to around $464 billion, if it was implemented, these are pre-COVID numbers, that as a result of that, Iran would have been closer to Europe and to United States. The Russians don't want it. The Chinese are sort of on the fence because of their tremendous economic trade volume with the United States. But Mr. Raisi's visit to Russia perhaps gave a signal that, look, there are alternatives to this. And the Russians, especially in this current mood over the Ukrainian crisis, are sending their own signals, Iran being a negotiating pawn for them. So if it doesn't go through, if the JCPOA, the P4 plus one, and if the U.S. comes back, doesn't go through U.S. Congress, not unanimously, but at least, the majority of it, then you have something recorded. But to threaten the country that the next president might not, keep up with the promises with the last administration would take away the little bit of credibility that Washington still has left. As far as the French that I was mentioning, Danny, you can't trust Emmanuel Macron. After all, the French, unfortunately, are delusional and uber arrogant enough to think they can negotiate over Iran's missiles program, which falls under the IRGC. It's never going to be negotiated. That's the only way Iran can defend itself, and it's completely indigenous, by the way, their advancement in that area. So there is a deficit of reliability. There's a deficit of legitimacy from whatever comes out of Washington. Also, there is division within the negotiating team, within Biden's negotiating team. We had two or three people who left already. That's sort of sending signals about the lack of cohesion in that administration. And last thing to say is the inflationary problem that we have in the United States. We haven't had anything like this in 40 years. The price of oil, last time I checked, was $83 a barrel. Negotiating with Iran would perhaps bring down the oil prices. This would be a domestic political victory for President Biden. There are talks that we are gonna, the Democrats are going to lose the midterm election primarily because of inflation. Inflation can be felt by everybody.
Thank you, Alexander. Always a pleasure to check in with you, bud. Stay safe. From Irvine, California, Alexander Azadgan, academic and geopolitical policy advisor. Now, the Iraqi military says it's killed 9 Daesh terrorists in an airstrike in the eastern province of Diyala. It says terrorists were killed in 3 precision strikes carried out after identifying their exact whereabouts. 9 were implicated in a deadly attack on an Iraqi military base in Diyala earlier this month. 11 soldiers were killed in the assault, deadliest attack carried out by Daesh terror group in Iraq this year. Attack fearing terrorists seized control of large swaths of land in Iraq and Syria back in 2014. Iraq's armed forces, backed by popular fighters, managed to fully liberate the occupied areas in 2017. The Syrian government has initiated a reconciliation process for towns and villages in southern Damascus countryside. This is implementation of the state's strategy to restore peace and normal life to areas previously witnessing violence across the country. Our Syria correspondent, Muhammad Ali, reports.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There is an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
A non-governmental organization in the U.S. has released a short film documenting the killing of 77 Palestinian children by Israeli forces in 2021.
How many children did Israeli forces kill in 2021? Israelis killed 78 Palestinian children in 2021, 61 in the Gaza Strip, 17 in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. 19 were shot and killed by live ammunition. Most were shot and killed in the context of demonstrations and did not present a direct threat to life or of serious injury.
Now, the film posted online is part of a campaign to stop Washington's financial support for the Israeli regime. According to If Americans Knew, U.S. taxpayers that has supplied Israel with almost $5 billion in military aid last year. The NGO says that Washington has provided Tel Aviv with at least $10.5 million worth of military aid per day during the fiscal year 2021. It's also called for Congress to show the film to its various committees to raise awareness about Israel's continued crimes against Palestinians. The regime is facing pressure from several UN agencies for its arbitrary and indefinite detention of Palestinian children as well. And now joining us for our news review program here is Mr. Jonathan Kutob, co-founder of Al-Haq, a human rights organization from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Ms. Allison, we are founder, If Americans Knew, from Sacramento, California. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Allison Weir, we're going to start with you. A great piece of work, by the way. We should start with that. And secondly, why you? Why does this something this disheartening, this eyebrow raising, have to come with you from you and not from U.S. corporate media or politicians up on Capitol Hill, ma'am?
Well, I think the corporate media are largely in the pocket of Israel partisans, so they're very, very gentle with this issue. It had to take someone like our nonprofit organization that's dedicated to giving Americans the full facts on this issue. We're nonpartisan. We're not Democrats or Republicans. We just believe it's extremely important that the American public learn what's going on in Israel-Palestine and also learn that we give Israel this massive amount of money. Most Americans have no idea that's going on. So we felt it was important to show people, these children, to see their faces, to learn about them, and to understand that our tax dollars were used in their tragic deaths.
Thank you, ma'am. And Mr. Jonathan Kutob, welcome to the program, sir. Your initial thoughts on this. We see even an uptake on Israeli crimes against Palestinians, aggression against Palestinians. What do you think it's going to take for the international community to put enough pressure on U.S. lawmakers until we finally see the Israeli regime held to account for these kind of atrocities?
Well, I think the first and most important thing is to have what President Biden refers to as a rules-based international order. We must have a system where the entire globe feels that human rights are important values, rather than political tools to be used when they are in your favor. Universal human rights means that they are true regardless of whether the particular practice is being done by friend or foe. If we are not willing to condemn human rights violations by our own friends and our own governments and our own regimes, then we have no business talking about human rights violations of international law.
And Ms. Weir, why doesn't the Israeli regime feel the need to uphold the same standards as everyone else when it comes to protesting the right to assemble, the right to protest, the right to protect the child?
I think what they feel, they have a political calculus. They understand that even though this has lessened a little bit, the pro-Israel lobby in the United States is very powerful. Campaign donors are very significant. They give, if you look at the top 10 donors to Joe Biden, you see that many of them are Israel partisans. So they understand that they right now largely have enormous influence over the United States. The United States at this point in history is very powerful in the world. So by influencing what the U.S. will do, it influences the whole world, and they continue to get away with massive human rights violations, which they've been doing for over 70 years now. It's gone on many years. But with the internet, I think more people are waking up. I knew nothing about this issue 20 years ago. I was a very, very typical American. I happened to be a Christian background. I didn't know these facts about Palestine, and now more people are starting to learn them. I think that's what will bring the change. Eventually, that will bring the change.
And Mr. Kutob, your final thoughts on children in occupied territories living under apartheid, living and dying under occupation?
Well, the problem is not even just the number of children who are killed. The number is that there is a regime that continuously creates a threat and restricts the rights of people in Gaza. Children and grown-ups are living under siege. And this is not a temporary state of affairs. It's not an emergency. It's not a war situation. It's a permanent state of affairs. For 50 years now, the occupied territories have been under occupation. For 70 years, all of Palestine has been living under an apartheid regime that privileges Jews over non-Jews, and openly says that. Openly says this is a state that serves and Jews at the expense of non-Jews, even if they are indigenous to the country. This is a very difficult thing, I think, to sustain in the long run. They have the power, they have the support of the United States and other governments throughout the world, but they are really running counter the movement of history, which is a movement for equality, a movement for human rights, and a movement for democracy, even though these values are often violated throughout the world.
Bless you, and thank you again for your fine piece of work. And I'd like to thank you both for joining us on the program. Stay safe to both of you. Allison Weir joining us from Sacramento, California, and Mr. Jonathan Kutal joining us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Russian troops are in Belarus for joint military drills in less than 2 weeks. Russian Defense Ministry has released footage of the arrival of its soldiers. It's also issued a statement saying these drills are aimed at practicing coordination of allied forces. Joint exercises are set to start February the 10th for about 10 days, and this amid simmering tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. NATO says it is closely watching the Russian developments in Belarus. Meantime, the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, says his country will go to war if Russia is attacked. Lukashenko says Belarus is prepared to host hundreds of thousands of Russian troops in case of a conflict. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
With Justice Stephen Breyer's announcement that he will retire from the U.S. Supreme Court this summer, President Joe Biden has a chance to take the landmark step of putting the first black woman on the court while shaping the future of jurisprudence. article you're about to hear has been written by Stephanie Cutter, a Democratic political strategist who was a senior advisor to President Barack Obama, as well as a top aide to Senators Harry Reid and Edward Kennedy. The article has been published in the New York Times opinion section, and it's titled, Democrats Should Take a Page from Mitch McConnell's Book. Justice Stephen Breyer's announcement that he will retire from the U.S. Supreme Court this summer, President Joe Biden has a chance to take the landmark step of putting the first black woman on the Supreme Court, while shaping the future of jurisprudence. Thanks to President Donald Trump and the former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, there is a new set of rules in place for Supreme Court nominations that all but guarantee Democrats will succeed. Unless, of course, we mess it up. In 2009, when President Barack Obama nominated Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, our team shepherded the nominee through the halls of the Senate for courtesy calls with 89 senators, most of whom waited to announce their intended vote until the Judiciary Committee did its work in vetting and questioning her. Not until that process was complete could they take the measure of her fitness to serve on the court. Those days are gone, of course. Joe Biden shouldn't look to the process we followed in the Sotomayor nomination. Instead, he should look to the nomination and confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Over Donald Trump's term in office, Republicans distilled the Supreme Court nomination process to pure politics. Instead of spending weeks scrutinizing a nominee's rulings and passing legal intricacies for potential hearing questions, they simply rubber-stamped Donald Trump's picks. Even before Donald Trump announced his nominee to succeed Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, declared that he had enough votes to confirm any nominee in both the Judiciary Committee and on the Senate floor. And within minutes of the president's nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, Republican senators began to declare their support for her. 38 days after Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, her successor was confirmed. The process exemplified one of the defining features of the modern Republican Party. It lays a focus on the judiciary and its extraordinary discipline in filling seats with its members' control of the Senate or blocking confirmations when they do not. While some Senate institutionalists may disagree with this new normal, we would be foolish not to understand it. Qualifications are critical and must be verified, but speed is also essential. Democrats should take a page from Mitch McConnell's book and move as quickly as possible. Senators who stoke suspense over how they will vote only create fodder for the news media to focus on divisions among Democrats, rather than on the Republicans who are already laying the groundwork to oppose this historic pick. Although Justice Stephen Breyer won't step down until June or July, Joe Biden should narrow his list and announce his selection as soon as possible, and Senate Democrats should move quickly to confirm her. In 2017, when Senator Mitch McConnell didn't like Democrats filibustering President Trump's first Supreme Court pick for the same seat that he denied Merrick Garland, he blew up the 60-vote threshold so that nominees could be confirmed with just a simple majority. This was, of course, a tit-for-tat response to Senator Harry Reid's changing those rules for lower court nominees. With Vice President Kamala Harris's vote, Democrats now have the seats they need to confirm a new justice. Despite the new Senate rules being in their favor, Democrats need to eliminate all possible roadblocks. President Biden and Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, have been extremely successful in holding Democrats together to approve a diverse set of judicial appointments, setting a record for confirming 42 in the president's first year. That's a sign that Democrats have a winning strategy for filling court seats. So here's my message to Democrats. Let's not overthink this. Shortly after Justice Breyer's plans to retire were revealed on Wednesday, 26th of January, Chuck Schumer said President Biden's nominee would be considered with all deliberate speed. Mr. Biden said that he'd announce his nominee within a month, and from there, the White House suggested the nomination process could take several weeks. But given that the president is a former Senate Judiciary Committee and his chief of staff, Ron Klain, was a top aide on that panel, the Biden team likely has a short list and possibly a favorite already in mind. Unquestionably, the women on that list are extremely qualified, but we also have no margin for error. So the nominee would ideally be someone with a legal resume that parallels that of sitting justices or a current federal judge with a recent record of unanimous Democratic support. Even better, the nominee would attract a handful of Republican votes. One potential frontrunner for the nomination, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, won the support of three GOP senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Susan Collins of Maine, when she was confirmed last June to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Although the bar is higher for the U.S. Supreme Court seats, a recent record of support starts the debate further down the field. An overly deliberative process would add nothing in an environment this toxic and divisive. No one doubts that some Republicans will pluck a line out of a long-ago legal brief by the nominee and try to spin it as a fatal flaw or attempt to stoke racial tensions by demeaning her credentials. So we should not give more room for the opposition to tarnish the nominee. We need to set a strategy and timeline, ignoring those critical of a fair but expedited nomination process, including from inside our own party, and maintain singular focus until the president's nominee is confirmed. Moving fast isn't just a defensive move, it can also help rally the nation. We know that President Biden has committed to nominating the first black woman to the court. As for any nominee, her qualifications will lead the way. But when President Obama nominated the first Latina, Justice Sotomayor, it was her incredible life story of growing up in the Bronx as the daughter of parents from Puerto Rico that won the hearts and minds of many Americans, even potential critics like Senator Lindsey Graham. She remained the Supreme Court's most popular justice. The moment Justice Stephen Breyer's replacement is announced, she will instantly become a historic figure. Every woman known to be a contender has a rich story to tell and will set a powerful example for generations of Americans to come. Let's hurry up and introduce her and get her ready to join the court.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So today when you look at the media all around the world, a type of harsh, violent, barbaric picture is made out of the religion of Islam, especially with the creation of such groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the suicide bombing, you know, here and there. Especially the people in the West has a wrong view regarding the religion of Islam and the true teachings of Islam. Today we want to talk about this topic, how the religion of Islam can help international bodies to establish peace all around the world. Said Mursal, let's start with you, brother. Islam is really a peaceful religion, isn't it?
Well, thank you very much. If you look at the word Islam itself, it has its deep root in peace and comfort. So these days we know that peacekeeping is a very essential and important part of everybody's life. I mean, the whole humanity needs to take refuge to peacekeeping. Otherwise, the same skirmish that we can see around the world is happening.
That's right.
And unfortunately, conflict and fights, have taken over, you know, to many parts of the world, even very small communities around the world. So unfortunately, some biased medias are trying to instill this wrong idea that religious conflict is the root of all these problems around the world. And we know that it has become a very important issue these days.
Okay.
So the religion of Islam is very much interested and even is trying to disseminate this true ideology that peace and religion are together. So any religion who's trying to propagate conflict, discomfort and problems is not actually a true religion. So
right.
Islam is telling us that peacekeeping or keeping peace among all humanity is very essential and is necessary.
Okay, and there have been so many conversions to the religion of Islam because of the peace that it brings into the society and also at the individual mental level. You know, the people was converted. When you ask them, one of the reasons is this tranquility, calmness, and peace of mind that it brings to you. This is one individual aspect, but when you look at the societal, social, collective aspect, you can find also this kind of peace. Sayyid Mohsen, what's your comment on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, we should know that that the religion has a strong influence on the people.
Yes.
In belief and in their faith. So, and we know that the people, they cannot live without having a belief or faith. Even the atheists do have a belief on which they obviously rely. Therefore, we see different religions in the world, and we see people divided into different religions. But the Islam, as brother has said in its name, it has the word peace itself. And according to one meaning, we refer to the religion of peace. Therefore, Islam has a big contribution in order to make a peace. And obviously, it depends whether we follow the Islam in its true way or not. Because everything has two kinds of use. It can be used properly or it can be misused. So when we talk about the religion of Islam and its contribution towards the peace in the world, we can see that the Islam is the complete version of all the religions.
Okay.
And it has everything within it. And because it's the final religion, we can say like from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm. Therefore, it also refers to the peace as well. And on top of that, we, the slogans even in the Quran and that are given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these are not general or general slogans. For example, when he talks about his prophet, he wants to introduce his prophet, he says he's Rahmatul Lil Alameen.
Yes.
He's the mercy for all the worlds. So the one who's mercy for all the worlds means that he is the bringer of peace to all the worlds, basically.
Absolutely.
So when we talk about the worlds, obviously it's different
yes.
states.
Okay.
So we can say like Islam has a big contribution if we really follow the true Islam.
That's right.
Because nowadays the problem is that the enemies are propagating against Islam
yes.
and people do not know the real source
yes.
of the Islam.
That's right. But say Murtaza, there is still some doubts and questions regarding the misunderstanding out of the religion of Islam, because the extremist groups who are really the pioneers of showing a kind of violent, barbaric picture of Islam to the world, refer to the same text of the Holy Quran that calls Prophet Muhammad as Rahmatul Lil Alameen. But they understood it in this way to kill here and there, to commit suicide, you know, and such, you know, violent actions that are every day shown on the Western media, on the news, you know,
here and there. You can find, you know, so many clips, video clips, the audios here and there. And that's why even some of the scholars of religions in the world at the universities believe that these violent things are based on the very text of the Quran and the context in which Islam was created. What's your answer to that?
Well, actually, let's look at the wrong misinterpretation of some verses of the Holy Quran. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, some people that you call them scholars, they have their own interpretations which has no actually base and roots in Islamic principles and ideologies. And unfortunately, we have this idea that the religious leaders who have a very crucial role in bringing peace into communities, highly important to know, and it's really good to know that we all have a very important task to establish peace mm-hmm. among all communities. This part has been forgotten by these people, that they are just by name scholars.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they are not very much involved in interpreting the true aspects of some verses of the Holy Quran.
Okay.
So these pictures that have been broadcasted around the world are just coming from those interpretations that are not true. So on the other hand, we have another downside of this issue, that many scholars do not get themselves involved in providing the true interpretation of those verses and give them the information and give such information to those who are going to fight in order to bring peace, not to bring conflicts.
That's right.
So some fighting is not all about creating conflicts. People sometimes are dragged into fighting. I can call them not fight jihad because they want to bring peace. Unfortunately, this has not been interpreted correctly.
That's right. This interpretation of the verses of the Quran, and the thing is that they delete some part and they add some part to the verses of the Holy Quran. The context in which that verse was revealed is not known to them. And if you look at the history and how much the religion of Islam could help establishing peace among the families and the societies on the Arab Peninsula at the time of Prophet Muhammad, it would be really beautiful from the side of the scholars. But Sayyid Mohsen, still, as I said, there are some commentaries written on the verses of the Holy Quran and the incidents, especially after the demise of the Prophet Muhammad, about the wars that took place by the Muslim leaders and the kings here and there in different lands of the societies, show that maybe Islam was spread by sword and not words. What's your answer to that, brother?
Well, the problem started right after the demise of the Prophet.
Okay.
And for your previous and the recent question which you asked, for both of them, the answer is that the main root of this diversion and this extremism that which we see in today's world, it's because right after the demise of Prophet, there were some people who said, Hasbuna Kitab Allah. The book of Allah is enough for us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the book of Allah brings the overall or general rules, and the detailed rules and the details are in the life of the Prophet, in the narrations of the Prophet. So when they left the Sunnah of the Prophet and the narrations of the Prophet, and they just attached, and they got the book only, which they couldn't even understand, because the book of Allah, Quran, has in its verses, there are some hidden meanings.
Yes.
There are some clear wordings. There are some mutashabih, there are some similar things which are said. There are some clear,
the muhkamat, mutashabihat
have different meanings, obviously, as well. But obviously, there is nasikh and mansukh. There was a rule, and later by the Prophet, it was overruled, and then the new rule came. So when we look at the Quran, it has different aspects. In order to understand the Quran, we need to refer back to the history of the revelation. Why this verse was revealed upon the Prophet, because of whom, what happened, who did what, so that the Prophet has said this, or Allah has revealed the verses. So when they left all these things, these details, and they just got the book on its own without the teacher, without the explanation which was given by the Prophet, we can see all those issues that happened into the Islam. And the picture today that we have, that Islam is spread by the sword, this was never happened in the life of Prophet.
Yes.
Prophet never invaded any place.
Yes.
Rather, the battles which he had, it was in defense of Islam. He was defending the Muslims.
Yes.
And at that time, yes, it is true that it was out of the Medina
Why? Because at that time, whenever there used to be a battle, they used to go at a common place,
right,
which was in the middle of like two countries or two places.
Okay.
So this was the reason, basically. So the main reason is when some people left the sayings of the Prophet, Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, which were obviously Allah has also emphasized on this. And the Prophet also said, I'm leaving amongst you two things, the Quran and Ahlul Bayt. So when they just got the Quran and they left Ahlul Bayt, they left the sayings of the Prophet narrations, the explanations about the verses. That's what happens generally.
Okay.
And this wrong picture that today we have is because of leaving the explanations given by the Prophet.
And the Ahlul Bayt also as the true exegesis of the Holy Quran. But in the 21st century, still after 14 centuries, after the relation of the Holy Quran to Prophet Muhammad and Islam, how do you think, Sayyid Murtaza, Islam and its teachings, its true teachings, I would like to very much use this term, pure Muhammadan Islam's teachings, you know, can help international bodies like these different international bodies that are working for peace, you know. Whenever you look at the main slogans and the mottos of these organizations, you can find peace. How Islam can help them in today's world?
You know, let's look at this question from another point of view.
Okay.
So all religions, including the religion of Islam, to some extent came, and it was descended to prophets to bring peace and bring nations together. So it is a duty we all have, and this has been bestowed upon us, that we must work very hard to teach and influence on each and every community on the earth in order to live and live a peaceful life and to be a follower of this peaceful life. So the religion of Islam has put a great emphasis on this aspect.
Okay.
And if you can see, wherever we have gatherings, meetings, the first thing that is been mentioned by the speakers and those leaders, especially religious leaders, is the unity.
Yes.
So when we talk about unity and the united nation, so it means that Islam is putting its greatest slogan and mottos on unity. So unity is not happening without understanding, without mutual understanding, especially about religious you know, matters.
That's right.
So the religion of Islam is focusing on similarities.
That's right.
The differences are not going to be given the first priority.
Okay.
So similarities bring people together.
Right.
So this aspect is the one that Islam has been propagated and has been talked about this matter over centuries.
That's all right. Especially as you said, reaching a kind of common ground among the Islamic leaders between themselves and also the leaders of the other religious communities and being united is a really important one. You know, the meetings that are happening today and the dialogue, both interfaith and intrafaith dialogues that are taking place and established in today's world, show that all religious leaders are after making this peace in the world and not the conflict. But unfortunately, this media and the power of the media is showing it the way around.
And of course, you know that we need to work in order to build relationships.
Yes.
And relations of trust.
Okay.
You know, with other religions.
Yes.
And this is what Islam has been always doing. You know, over the past centuries, we had our infallible imams,
yes,
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And on top of all, we have the Book of Islam, Quran, is telling us and its followers that a amicable relationship with other religions and with other followers of the other religions is really of a great importance. So this shows that Islam has already said clearly that peace with and to other nations and anyone is very important.
That's all right. Said Mohsen, thank you very much, brothers, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints regarding how the religion of Islam can establish peace in today's world. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, view our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The January 6th House Committee has demanded information from 14 people who were part of a bogus slate of electors for President Donald J. Trump, digging deeper into an aspect of Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, January 6th Committee Subpoenas Fake Trump Electors. House Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack issued 14 subpoenas on Friday, 28th of January, to people who falsely claimed to be electors for President Donald J. Trump in the 2020 presidential election in states that were actually won by Joseph R. Biden Jr., digging deeper into Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the election results. The subpoenas target individuals who met and submitted false electoral college certificates in seven states won by President Biden: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Select Committee is seeking information about attempts in multiple states to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, including the planning and coordination of efforts to send false slates of electors to the National Archives. Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi and the chairman of the House Select Committee, said in a statement. Benny Thompson added, "We believe the individuals we have subpoenaed today have information about how these so-called alternate electors met and who was behind that scheme." the so-called alternate electors met on 14th of December 2020 in seven states that Donald Trump lost and submitted bogus slates of Electoral College votes for him, the committee said. They then sent the false Electoral College certificates to Congress, an action Donald Trump's allies used to try to justify delaying or blocking the final step in confirming the 2020 election results. A joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021 to formally count the electoral votes. The 14 individuals subpoenaed by the House Select Committee on Friday were Nancy Cottle and Lorraine Pellegrino of Arizona, David Schaefer and Sean Steele of Georgia, Kathy Burden and Mayra Rodriguez of Michigan, Jewel Powdrell and Deborah Mistas of New Mexico, Michael McDonald and James DeGraffenried of Nevada, Bill Batchenberg and Lisa Patton of Pennsylvania, and Andrew Hitt and Kelly Rue of Wisconsin. The subpoenas order the witnesses, all of whom claim to be either a chair or secretary of the fake electoral slates, to turn over documents and sit for depositions in February. Those who signed onto the fake slates of electors were mostly state-level officials in the Republican Party, GOP, political candidates, or party activists involved with Donald Trump's re-election campaign. None of those who were subpoenaed responded on Friday to requests for comment. On Friday, 28th of January, the committee also issued a subpoena to Judd Deer, a former White House spokesman who interacted with Donald Trump the day before the Capitol riot in a meeting in which Donald Trump asked how to get Republicans in Congress he described as weak to overturn the election, according to a person familiar with the panel's activities. That subpoena was reported earlier by CNN. The committee's latest subpoenas came as the Justice Department said this week it was investigating the fake electors. The scheme to employ the so-called alternate electors was one of Donald Trump's most expansive efforts to overturn the election result, beginning even before some states had finished counting ballots, and culminating in pressure placed on Vice President Mike Pence to throw out legitimate votes for Joe Biden when he presided over a joint congressional session on 6th of January. At various times, the gambit involved lawyers, state lawmakers, and top White House aides. As early as 4th of November, Mark Meadows, then Donald Trump's chief of staff, received a message from an unidentified Republican lawmaker proposing an aggressive strategy to maintain his grip on power. According to the strategy, Republican-controlled legislatures in states like Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania would just send their own electors to the Electoral College instead of those chosen by voters to represent Joe Biden. Within a month, two of Donald Trump's lawyers, Rudolph Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, spoke to Republican lawmakers in swing states like Michigan and Arizona, urging them to convene special sessions to choose their own electors. Around the same time, John Eastman, another lawyer who would ultimately work for Donald Trump, spoke by video to lawmakers in Georgia, advising them to adopt a slate of electors yourself. As the plan became public, it was widely ridiculed by legal scholars as a futile attempt to subvert the will of the voters. Nevertheless, several prominent conservatives, among them the writer L. Brent Bozzel III and former Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, signed an open letter on 10th of December 2020, calling on lawmakers in competitive states to exercise their plenary power and appoint clean slates of electors to the Electoral College to support President Trump. 4 days later, the day the Electoral College met, state lawmakers in several contested swing states drafted and signed the fake slates. To promote the plan, Phil Klein, the director of the Amistad Project, a conservative legal group that was working with Donald Trump's lawyers on lawsuits to challenge the election, fanned across right-wing media outlets that day. And Stephen Miller, a top advisor to Donald Trump, announced on Fox News Channel that state lawmakers in several key swing states were in the process of sending an alternate slate of electors to Congress. Even after the Electoral College ignored the fake electors and certified Joe Biden's victory, Donald Trump's allies continued to push the scheme. On 22nd of December 2020, the Amistad Project filed a federal lawsuit, asking a judge to essentially force Mike Pence to recognize the fake electoral slates when he presided over Congress's official count on 6th of January 2021. While the lawsuit was dismissed, a Justice Department official, Jeffrey Clark, drafted a letter 1 week later laying out a plan to persuade officials in Georgia to call back their Biden electors and consider swapping them for those who support Donald Trump. The letter was never sent. The scheme gathered momentum as 6th of January approached. On 31st of December 2020, according to the Politico website, Jenna Ellis wrote a legal memo to Donald Trump advising him that six states had electoral delegates in dispute and that because of this conflict, Mike Pence should not accept any electors from them, but rather ask state lawmakers which slate they wanted to use. On 5th of January 2021, with pressure building on Mike Pence, Jenna Ellis wrote a second memo reasserting the vice president's authority to refuse to consider electors from states that would have given Joe Biden a victory. Ultimately, the efforts were rejected by Mike Pence. Though he did not directly acknowledge the existence of alternate electors during the joint session, Mike Pence did amend the traditional script read by a vice president during such proceedings, adding language making clear that alternate slates of electors offered up by states were not considered legitimate. As he ticked through the states, Vice President Mike Pence said repeatedly that the results certified by the Electoral College, the parliamentarian has advised me, is the only certificate of vote from that state that purports to be a return from the state, and that has annexed to it a certificate from an authority of the state purporting to appoint and ascertain electors.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.